Welcome to Hyperglycemic Crisis. This is Beverly Tomasian. Today we'll be looking at underlying causes of hyperglycemia, including medications, and we'll be looking at diabetes, ketoacidosis, and hyperosmolar non-ketotic syndrome. During this program, we're going to be talking about the causes of hyperglycemia. We'll look at steroids and how they can impact blood sugars. We'll look at pathophysiology of diabetes ketoacidosis, also known as DKA, and we'll take a look at hyperosmolar hyperglycemic state, or HHS. We'll also discuss treatment for these different hyperglycemic crises. As we go through this presentation, I want you to be on the lookout for underlined yellow words. These underlined words indicate there's a link that you can click on for further information related to the topic we are presenting. The first topic we'll take a look at is morning hyperglycemia. So many of our patients say, I can't understand why my blood sugars are so high in the morning. I didn't eat anything past 8 o'clock, and yet my blood sugar seems to be elevated. Well, one of the reasons, often with our type 2s, is excessive hepatic glucose production. So we know with type 2 diabetes, there's a condition known as insulin resistance and insulin deficiency. When there's not enough insulin on board, the liver releases excessive glucose. So insulin really is a liver moderator in that it blocks the liver or slows the liver from breaking down its glycogen stores and releasing too much glucose. Many people with type 2 diabetes, because they make not enough insulin, and actually they over-secrete glucagon, and glucagon is a hormone that stimulates the liver to release glucose, they wake up with high morning blood sugars. So excessive hepatic glucose production associated usually with type 2 diabetes because there's not enough insulin on board to keep the liver in check throughout the night. And you might want to think about, how can we fix that situation? Well, we'll get to that in a minute. The next thing I want to point out is what I have here is rebound hyperglycemia, or Somogyi effect. Rebound hyperglycemia is simply a situation where blood sugars go too low, usually during the middle of the night. And when blood sugars reach a certain threshold, usually less than 70, there's counterregulatory hormones that are released. And those include adrenaline, growth hormone, cortisol, glucagon. And all of these hormones work to get that blood sugar back up to where it needs to be. And sometimes they do their job a little bit too well, and we get excessive hyperglycemia. So rebound hyperglycemia is often attributed to low blood sugar, and we're talking about the middle of the night in this situation, low blood sugar in the middle of the night, or nocturnal hypoglycemia, causing the release of counterregulatory hormones, which result in AM hyperglycemia. This can happen on type 1s or type 2s, but I normally see the situation on patients more toward the type 1 spectrum who are more insulin deficient and have had a history of low blood sugars. Lastly, we have the Dawn phenomena. Now, the Dawn phenomena is associated with type 1 diabetes, and around 4 a.m. we release more growth hormone and cortisol. And if you have diabetes and you don't make insulin or enough insulin, the growth hormone and cortisol released around 4 a.m. can cause blood sugar levels to go too high. And that is what we call the Dawn phenomena. So let's take a look and see how we can fix each of these different situations. For excessive hepatic glucose production and morning hyperglycemia, we have listed here exercise, metformin, or nighttime basal insulin. As a matter of fact, there was a recent study released that said that exercising after dinner can have a big impact on getting morning blood sugars down for those with type 2 diabetes. And when I say exercise, it's just a 10-minute walk after dinner. I'm really encouraging all of my patients to get up and walk after dinner. The other medication that's really helpful in preventing the liver from releasing too much glucose is metformin. Metformin is very effective when taken at night to get morning blood sugars to target range. And we also have our friend basal insulin. So taking Lantus, MPH, Detemir in the evening hours
helps to prevent excessive hepatic glucose production. Now, what about this next situation, rebound hyperglycemia, where we're getting too low in the middle of the night? Most important thing we want to do is prevent nocturnal lows. So we're going to look at the evening medication, whether that's orals or insulin, and usually we'll need to cut back on those to prevent those hypoglycemic events. For the dawn phenomena, this can be a tricky situation for patients who are not on an insulin pump. But for our patients on insulin pump, they can just adjust their basal rate in the morning around 4 a.m. and increase it just by a few notches and on their insulin pump, and they can get really excellent blood glucose control that way. If they're not on an insulin pump, we would have to adjust their basal the night before. And I've had a few patients who wake up around 4 a.m. and give themselves a little bolus insulin to help get that morning blood sugar to target. I want to discuss medications that are linked to hyperglycemia. And I have four listed here, but I want to spend most of the time on the two in green. Atypical antipsychotics, steroids, Dilantin. If you're taking the CDE exam, this used to show up on a lot of exams that ask what medications can cause hyperglycemia. So we still have that listed on this list here. And protease inhibitors for our HIV patients. Protease inhibitors can actually cause some pancreatic beta cell dysfunction and lead to hyperglycemia. So these are all good to know, but the next few slides, I'll discuss the first two on this list in more detail. Starting in early 2000, the Food and Drug Administration noticed that patients on novel antipsychotics, often called atypical antipsychotics, and these are used to treat mental disorders and schizophrenia, were experiencing severe hyperglycemia. As a matter of fact, there were a few deaths associated with this hyperglycemic crisis. So the medications we have listed here do have a black box warning. Any patient started on these medications should be evaluated on a regular basis for hyperglycemia, and they should be taught the signs of high blood sugar to report to their provider right away. They're not really sure what the mechanism is behind this, but we do know that patients on these drugs, about 80% of patients taking one of these drugs, do gain weight. And we also know that mental disorders are associated with diabetes. So perhaps it's a weight gain plus a mental disorder in combination when you add on this medication just really expresses the hyperglycemic aspect of that particular person. So again, just letting you know that any patients on these medications, we need to keep a close eye on their blood glucose levels. And many people with diabetes are on these medications, which can exacerbate blood sugar levels even further. So we're going to need to monitor them very closely. Another common cause of hyperglycemia in patients without diabetes, and it can really raise blood sugar levels in people with diabetes, are steroids. Steroids raise the blood sugar in different ways. They're counterregulatory hormones. They imitate our counterregulatory hormones, so they cause insulin resistance. So the insulin we do have doesn't work as well. They promote glucose production in the liver, so they're stimulating a stress state in our body. The liver's ramping up and releasing more sugar, and they also decrease insulin production, and the insulin that is made does not work as well. You'll see in patients who are taking steroids, their blood sugars go particularly high late afternoon. And you'll see that in the morning, their blood sugars look pretty good. But by lunchtime and before dinner, we'll see the peak of the steroid effect on blood sugars. So steroids can affect patients in different ways. And I just have different situations here and how it can affect blood sugars. So a patient has no prior history of diabetes, started on steroids, and the blood glucose levels could increase while they're on the steroids, but normalize when the medication is stopped. So this is a very common scenario. We put a patient on prednisone, maybe they're having some asthma or breathing trouble, blood sugars are up. We stop the prednisone, blood sugars normalize. That doesn't mean the patient is no longer at risk for diabetes, because truly what I think about is a steroid is a pancreatic stress test. The steroids see how well does the pancreas work under a stress situation, And if the pancreas can't handle the glucose levels in that stress situation, I know that probably some of those beta cells are lost. So even though the blood sugar is normalized when the prednisone or steroid is stopped, I know this person's at future risk for diabetes. And usually if we do a good HMP, we can find out that patient maybe has prediabetes or diabetes runs in their family. And so you can already see the genetics are putting them at risk and their history is pointing us toward their increased risk of diabetes. So we're going to have this patient monitor their blood sugars on a regular basis, maybe every 3 months, and know to report any signs of hyperglycemia to their provider right away. Another situation is that blood glucose levels may increase. So you put them on a steroid, the sugar levels go up, and they stay up even when the steroid is stopped. So now the person has diabetes. So we could say the steroid exacerbated a pre-existing risk for diabetes, and now that patient has diabetes and will need to be treated with monitoring of blood glucose, medications, probably, and looking at nutrition therapy, of course, and exercise. Either way, the situation requires evaluation and ongoing treatment. Now, what about this person who has diabetes and started on steroid? Well, we know what's going to happen. That steroid is going to crank up their blood sugars. So even if our patient's already on oral medications, they may not be enough. Most patients with diabetes started on steroids need some insulin therapy to help prevent a hyperglycemic crisis. And we'll talk about strategies in the next slide. When we think about strategies to manage steroid-induced hyperglycemia, or SIH, if the patient has no prior history of diabetes, oral agents actually may work. So they're just, we call insulin naive or diabetes naive. They may respond to oral medications. You may want to try sulfonylurea or metformin, but they may need insulin. Insulin will always work to get blood sugars down. So we're just going to evaluate the whole patient and see where they at. Can they handle insulin right now? What are their other chronic comorbidities, and what is their health situation like at that moment? If the patient already has a history of diabetes, their insulin needs may actually double or triple. So they're going to need a lot more insulin, and especially I tend to focus on using the bolus insulin. The basal insulin you could increase, but to really get those blood sugars down, bolus insulin, particularly at lunch, seems to really help manage blood sugars and get them to target. When we think about steroids, when you take them in the morning, they really do impact blood glucose levels most post-lunch and before dinner. So we could consider 70-30 in the morning. 70-30, it seems to be a really effective way to get the blood sugar down between lunch and dinner, or even MPH. We know MPH is a peak of 4 to 10 hours. So it's actually very well suited to work against the hyperglycemic effect of the steroid. Or we could try mealtime bolus. And again, that mealtime bolus at lunch is very effective. Also, of course, at breakfast. So if you give a nice mealtime bolus at before breakfast, it can help prevent the lunch from going high, and then giving us some at lunch to prevent that dinner from getting too high. But I do want to point out something very important, that patients on steroids have a drop in their blood sugars overnight. It's just the way it works. So they generally need very little insulin to cover them throughout the night, and I'm very cautious about over insulinizing them at bedtime. So don't go overboard on the Lantus or the MPH or the Dedamir at bedtime, because they will just need their usual dose. Their blood sugars will trend down overnight. You want to keep it flexible. Steroid levels go up and they come down. We want to give patients scales that can match their steroid use. So if I know a patient's on chronic steroids, I'll say, well, when you're on 10 milligrams, here's your scale. 20, I might have a different one, or 30. And so that way, when they increase or when they decrease in their steroid, they have a plan ahead of time. And of course, we're gonna, you know, check with their provider and make sure this plan works for everyone. But I think that is one of the best strategies that I've seen when we consider patients on steroids and keeping it flexible and matching their particular needs. Let's move on to hyperglycemic crisis, including diabetes, ketoacidosis, and hyperglycemic hyperosmolar non-ketotic syndrome. You may not see these different situations very often in your clinical practice. If you are an inpatient diabetes educator and you respond to all of these, you'll see them more. But for many of us who work on the inpatient and outpatient side, we may not interact with this condition very regularly. However, it's really important to have a good understanding of the pathophysiology behind DKA and HHS and the main treatment strategies. Also, if you're going to be taking the exam, we'll be highlighting key points to keep in mind in preparation for that. Diabetes ketoacidosis is not a very common condition, but it does cost a lot of money and it causes a lot of heartache. There's 135,000 hospitalizations a year for DKA, and if you look at how much is spent on it, there's $2.4 billion spent a year on treatment in the United States. And when I think about diabetes ketoacidosis, I often think it's a cry for help, that this patient or this person is really struggling with managing their diabetes, and there's things happening in their world that is making it difficult for them to really succeed with their diabetes management. We'll talk about that more. I do want to point out there is an article here on hyperglycemic crises, and this is through the American Diabetes Association Diabetes Care Journal, and it's a real nice summary of the pathophysiology and the treatment for DKA and HHS. When we have a patient admitted with DKA, I think it's really important to stand back and think, what brought them to this place of this hyperglycemic crisis? And certainly 25 to 30% of the time, it's due to illness or infection. And I've seen patients who are very savvy with their type 1 diabetes, know a lot about it, manage it well 99% of the time. Sometimes that illness is so overwhelming in their body, so many stress hormones are released, that despite their best efforts to give enough insulin but by pump or by injection, they just can't overcome the hyperglycemia. And so they end up coming to the emergency room, which is very appropriate, to get IV insulin to help get blood sugars back to target. But if you look here, 50% of the time, DKA is due to inadequate insulin dose. So when I think about this, I think about a person maybe not very knowledgeable about their type 1 diabetes. Maybe they were a little bit sick and they just didn't give enough insulin. But the other thing that comes to mind is somebody really struggling with their diabetes. Maybe this person has diabulimia. And diabulimia is when people don't take enough insulin to let their blood sugars run high with the main goal of weight loss and weight management. So many of these patients over time, since they're underdosing insulin, end up coming to the hospital in ketoacidosis. Another situation is it could be initial manifestation of type 1. This person, you know, had the genetics for type 1 diabetes and then the gene just switched on. Maybe they were exposed to a virus, an illness. Who knows? Maybe they reach puberty and so they are experiencing a hyperglycemic crisis. So DKA is oftentimes the first time the person knows they have type 1 diabetes. They've reached a point where they feel bad enough they seek care. But as I mentioned in my previous slide, DKA can be a cry for help. Maybe there's emotional stress, especially with teens, or sometimes there's neglect or mismanagement. And that is maybe the parents are under-involved, maybe they're over-involved, maybe there's mental health issues with that child. And so whenever I have a patient come in with DKA and they know everything there is to know about diabetes and they know how much they should take and, you know, they are very smart about their diabetes, yet they keep ending up in the hospital, that really is a cry for help. And so at that point, we want to get social services and mental health involved to see how can we support this family or this person in successfully managing their diabetes. So what is DKA? Well, we know it's extreme hyperglycemia, but the real marker of DKA is profound insulin deficiency. You can't get diabetes ketoacidosis if you have enough insulin on board. So DKA always tells us this person needs insulin. What happens is the person is not getting enough insulin, so the body cannot use glucose for fuel. And that leads to the body using, I'm going to just skip down to this bullet point, it uses free fatty acids for fuel. And so if you don't have enough insulin, you can't use glucose for fuel. So the body has to go to a secondary source of fuel, and it relies on free fatty acids. Now, free fatty acids lead to ketone bodies, and we'll talk about this in a future slide, but ketone bodies are acidic, and so they cause the pH to go down, and that's where the crisis comes in. But the other thing I want to mention, besides a lack of insulin, there is an excess release of stress hormones. So in addition to low amounts of insulin, we have high blood sugar because there's stress hormones such as glucagon, epinephrine, and cortisol out there because the person's in a stress situation. And those hormones render whatever insulin is on board less effective. So if you put together this hyperglycemia and this increasing level of ketones in the blood, we have osmotic diuresis. So the person is trying to get rid of all this extra sugar in their blood. And the way the body does that is they release the sugar through the urine, osmotic diuresis. So the person is going to the bathroom a lot. And so they're getting more and more dehydrated. But along with that dehydration, as they're urinating a lot, electrolytes are being lost. And so we're seeing electrolyte imbalances. And initially we might see the potassium level go high, but as you keep diuresing, the potassium level drops. In addition, we're going to see acidosis because ketone bodies are acidotic, so that pH is trending down. And that's where the danger with DKA lies, in that lowering of the pH and acidosis. When you think about the signs and symptoms of diabetes ketoacidosis, we're definitely going to be looking out for these for anybody at risk for type 1 diabetes, if diabetes runs in their family, the autoimmune version. And also when they come to the emergency room, you might notice, of course, they're hyperglycemic because they don't make enough insulin. Now, this hyperglycemia can lead to weakness. There's sugar in their blood, but it can't get to the muscle to be used for energy. All that sugar is just running around in their bloodstream and being urinated out as much as possible. So these patients, their cognition is not very good. They may feel very tired, and they may actually be complaining of GI symptoms. Now, when you have excess ketone bodies in your blood, for some reason, it causes abdominal irritation. And sometimes these patients are misdiagnosed with appendicitis. So nausea and vomiting, abdominal pain, another sign. And then you might notice deep, rapid breathing, or Kussmaul's breathing. And this is associated with them trying to rid the acid. So they're trying to blow off that extra acetone. And so they'll have that deep, rapid breathing in an effort to get their pH back to balance. I've seen lots of patients get very cold, severe hypothermia. So you want to make sure you have those warm blankets available. And then that acetone breath you've heard about so many times, their breath smells musty or like acetone, like nail polish remover. But I always ask the family members, did you notice a change in the way their breath smelled? They might be breathing quickly to get rid of those acids. And again, changes in mentation. They may have lower reflexes and less tonicity of their muscles. And of course, as you can imagine, with all that osmotic diuresis, dehydration, and orthostatic hypotension. So these are all the signs and symptoms of DKA. And if you've ever seen somebody come to the emergency room or the hospital in DKA, many of these are present. And it's really unforgettable the way this person looks. They just looked very fatigued, very tired, poor cognition. And it's like their tank is on empty. That was how I would describe it. Because sure, they have all this sugar in their blood, but they can't access it. So they are running on fumes. Here's a diagram of diabetes ketoacidosis, which I think nicely wraps up what we've been talking about. With DKA, there's insufficient or absent insulin. And so the cells can't use glucose, as we've mentioned. So they start using fatty acids for energy. Now, insulin is a really important hormone because it lowers blood sugars, but it also inhibits fatty acid breakdown. This is really important because when you have fatty acid breakdown, as we're going to see right here, fatty acids are converted to ketones. And there's actually three ketones we talk about. The acetone that patients can blow off that we smell in their breath, it's a gas. And there's beta-hydroxybutyrate, and we'll measure that in their bloodstream to see how ketotic are they. And there's acetoacetate. So these ketones all have a negative charge and will cause the pH to head south, and you also see this reflected in the anion gap. So we'll see as these ketones are released in the bloodstream, we'll have increased levels of ketones and increased glucose production. I'm going to tell you what happens on the other end of the spectrum. Since the body can't use glucose for energy and there's not insulin on board, it starts actually doing gluconeogenesis and using other substrates to try and get glucose available for the muscles. So while this is going on, there's an increased level of glucose on one end, there's also an increased level of ketone bodies on the other end. But the main thing we're worried about is acidosis. And when that anion gap is greater than 12, we know we're running into trouble and we are in DKA. So far, we've been talking about extreme hyperglycemia in our patients with type 1. They get DKA. Let's switch gears and talk about our patients with type 2 diabetes. Patients with type 2, since they make some insulin, don't usually go into DKA. They go into a situation called hyperosmolar hyperglycemic state, or HHS. And the common scenario, truthfully, is an older patient who lives alone, they're not closely monitored, and they get sick, they get a flu, they get a virus, they get pneumonia. And what happens is maybe they're not eating well, maybe they're not drinking well. Many times they'll stop taking their diabetes medications because they're not eating like they think they should, and they don't want to take medications without food going in. And so what happens then, unbeknownst to them, since they're not really monitoring their blood sugars that much, their blood sugars are going higher and higher and higher. The symptoms may go unrecognized for weeks. So these are a lot of our older patients who are living alone, not closely monitored, who get sick on top of their other conditions, and they start really losing a lot of fluids. So they have blood sugars going up 500, 600, 700, 800. They're getting more and more tired. They're urinating more and more, osmotic diuresis. Their kidneys are trying to flush out that extra sugar. In addition to losing glucose, they're losing electrolytes and fluid. And so they get very debilitated. Other reasons besides illness that can cause hyperglycemic crisis in our type 2s are burns. You can imagine all the fluid loss associated with that and all this stress hormone release, diarrhea, hemodialysis, TPN, tube feedings, diuretics, steroids, all of these things. And the other thing is myocardial infarction. So a patient, you know, comes in with an MI, they may actually be in a hyperglycemic crisis. Those two can be associated with each other, in addition to infections, and hyperglycemic crisis are a very common combination. So now that we've discussed DKA and HHS, let's do a little differential and see what are the differences between these two. Well, DKA, the person is usually under the age of 40. Most people with type 1 diabetes are diagnosed before the age of 40, but the truth is it can happen at any time during the lifespan. But most commonly, they're on the younger side. HHS are usually 60 and above. Now, DKAs, look at this, very interesting. They usually only have symptoms for less than 2 days. They feel sick enough that they will show up in the emergency room and need care. So DKA makes you feel bad, tired. You just get a feeling something's wrong. But HHSers, more than 5 days of symptoms. So these are our elderly patients living alone many times, who are sick and don't really seek care early on. They don't feel bad enough. Or maybe they don't have transport to the hospital. DKA, the glucose is more than 250. I mean, DKAs, it may go up to 500 and 600. But HHS, they have severe hyperglycemia. I just heard of a patient who came into the emergency room with a glucose of 1900. So the blood sugars can go astronomically high and, you know, just shockingly high. And as you can imagine, when your blood sugar is that high, the body's trying to rid itself of all that extra glucose. So there's a lot of osmotic diuresis that happens. We talked about serum ketones. Serum ketones are a sign that the body can't use glucose for fuel. It's relying on fatty acids for fuel. So the DKA, they have no insulin. So we're going to see positive 3+ serum ketones. Where our HHSers rarely will have ketones because they have insulin on board to use glucose for fuel. They don't make enough of it, but they have enough insulin where they can still use glucose for fuel. So the DKAers, the pH is low and the anion gap is greater than 12. The pH on the DKAers, you can sometimes see it trending towards 7. And, you know, that's really threatening life at that point. So we see that pH really go low. But HHSers have normal pH and normal anion gaps. So as we've talked about, the DKA is usually type 1, where HHS is usually type 2. And you can see the mortality is higher on the type 2 with the hyperglycemic crisis. And that's because it's our more frail elderly patients usually, and they've had hyperglycemia for longer. Plus they have the electrolyte imbalances. And many times their potassium is either elevated or low, and they are at risk for arrhythmias. So this is a summary of these two conditions. And I think this is an excellent chart to be familiar with if you're going to be taking the exam, and also for our clinical practice. But, you know, in clinical practice, sometimes it may be a little less clear than this chart where the patients are. But generally speaking, type 1 DKA and type 2 HHS. Let's talk about a little bit more of the labs and then treatment. Let's look at the differential presentation and we look at labs between DKA and HHS. Initially, we might see the sodium is low, and that's dilutional hyponatremia. Since there's all that glucose in the blood, it pulls in water. So when there's all that water in there, the sodium level actually may look low. But as you continue to diurese, you start losing water and the sodium levels can look quite high. Potassium, a similar situation. When there's not enough insulin on board, potassium leaves a cell and goes into the vascular space. So initially, the potassium may look high when they first come in, but be ready for it to go down when you give insulin, because as you give that person insulin, potassium is pushed right back into the cell. So we're going to have to do some potassium replacement. The other thing is, if there's a lot of potassium in the vascular space and they're diuresing, the patients are going to lose potassium in their urine. They're going to diurese it right out. So initially the potassium is high and over time it starts to drop. As you can imagine, because this patient is so dry, the hemoglobin and hematocrit will be elevated, as well as the BUN and creatinine. And since they're in a stress state, the white count is elevated. Now, the pH, as we mentioned, if they have DKA, is going to be low. HHS will be normal. So what action do we take? Well, the first thing we're going to do in both of these situations is they need two things. They need insulin and they need fluid. That's the two most important things both of these patients need. And so the most important thing I have here, and you want to just put a circle around this if you're taking the exam, or in real life, it's important to know too, is that maintain insulin drip until ketone negative and the glucose is less than 200. So many times I've seen providers stop the insulin drip when the blood sugar is 180, 190, but the patient is still ketone positive. We have to wait until their pH and their anion gap is back to normal and they have no ketones left before we stop the drip. If we stop the drip before they're ketone negative, they can bounce right back into DKA. IV insulin only lasts for a few minutes. So once you shut that off, there is no insulin on board. The other thing around this is give sub-Q insulin before you DC the IV insulin. So we need to give them an injection of insulin under their skin before we stop the sub-Q, before we stop the IV insulin, because once we stop the IV insulin, there's no insulin running in. So always give a sub-Q injection before you DC IV insulin. We want to make sure to maintain hydration initially. We give them normal saline and then we change over to half normal saline. And then we actually many times go over to D5 because they're starving, their cells are starving. So once their blood sugar levels start dropping, we might give some D5 and a half normal saline, and we're going to throw some potassium in there usually. We're going to monitor their blood sugars very frequently in the acute phase, and as they stabilize, less frequently, but we're going to keep a close eye on their electrolytes, especially potassium. We want to make sure that their potassium levels are normalized to prevent arrhythmia and other problems. And I have down here teach. So we want to find out, really get to the heart of What happened? What brought you into the hospital? Why did you, go into DKA or HHS, and see what we can do to prevent it in the future? Because if we don't change course, they're going to end up back in our emergency room again in a similar situation. When we think about treatment of these two situations, DKA and HHS, the treatment is similar, but their priorities are a little bit different. With diabetic ketoacidosis, the first thing we really want to do is stop ketosis. How do we stop the body from burning fat for fuel? We give insulin. So insulin will certainly help lower the blood sugar, but most importantly, insulin allows the body to use glucose for fuel and stop using fat for energy. This halts ketosis and helps normalize pH and the anion gap. We're going to rehydrate. And normally with the treatment of DKA, we're going to hang 2 liters of normal saline and get fluids on board. Of course, if we have young children or anybody with congestive heart failure, we're going to be very conservative in our fluid replacement and thoughtful about it. But for most patients, they need those 2 liters of saline to get their fluid balance back to where it needs to be and stop dehydration. We're going to keep a close eye on their electrolytes, as we've mentioned before, and we're going to replace potassium initially as those potassium levels drop as insulin gets on board. We're going to keep a close eye on electrolytes. We're going to make sure that we prevent complications. We're going to address the causes of DKA and provide glucose. This is kind of interesting. As the blood sugars come down, we're going to need to replace glucose, because essentially the body has been in a starvation state. It hasn't been able to utilize the glucose on board. So when blood sugar levels are less than 300 or so, we are going to add glucose to the IV along with potassium and maybe half normal saline. Education is going to be very critical at this juncture. We're going to find out what brought the person in DKA, what were the precipitating factors, what educational information do they need focus on, and also providing them with resources, mental health support, and other referrals that will help prevent future DKA. The treatment of HHS is very similar, but we have a little bit of a different focus on HHS since it is a situation of severe dehydration from osmotic diuresis. The most important thing they need is fluids and rehydration. But simultaneously, we're going to give them insulin. The insulin will correct the blood sugar. So as the blood sugar goes down, osmotic diuresis decreases. For HHS, we rehydrate and get those blood sugars down to prevent further dehydration. We're going to correct electrolyte imbalances, and especially for our older population, keeping a close eye on that potassium to prevent any arrhythmias. In many of our older patients, we're going to have to be a little more conservative on fluid replacement, especially if they have any CHF. We're going to work on preventing complications, and really important for HHS, find out what brought them to this place. Was it an illness? Were they having a heart attack? Was it a tube feeding? Was it a hypertonic solution they might have been receiving? Is it under dosing of insulin or other diabetes medication? So we need to do a lot of problem solving to prevent this recurrence in the future. And of course, in both of these situations, including the family and support people in education to make sure they understand the severity of this hyperglycemic crisis and how to prevent it in the future. There are many algorithms available online for treatment of DKA and HHS, but all of these algorithms take into consideration these 5 most important interventions. The first one being insulin. We start our patients on an insulin drip, and the insulin drip is based on body weight, about 0.05 to 1 unit of insulin per kilogram per hour. This will help lower blood sugars and, for our DKA patients, stop ketosis. Fluids, very important. And as we've mentioned, we'll start with 2 liters of normal saline, switch over to half normal saline, and when blood glucose levels are less than 300, we can hang a bag of D5.5, and we'll probably replace electrolytes, most likely potassium. We're going to evaluate different electrolytes and replace as needed, including potassium, magnesium, calcium, and phosphate. We're going to talk with the patient and their support people and figure out what was a precipitating cause. Was there a knowledge gap or a resource gap? And how can we fix that and provide resources to prevent future episodes? Thank you very much for joining this program on DKA and HHS. As you're working in the hospital with patients in these conditions, keep in mind these basic principles and they will help guide your interventions and treatment plan.
We invite you to take advantage of other resources we offer on our webpage. We've listed some here for you. Of particular interest might be our medication pocket cards, which summarizes medications for diabetes and injectables. We have other free webinars coming up, and we have an article page which has an abundance of different topics relating to hyperglycemia and diabetes management. Thank you so much for joining our web clinic. You have 1 year to complete this program and take the post-test for your CE credit. However, if you would like that time extended, please feel free to contact us at the email listed below. To receive your CE credit, just complete the post-test and program survey. Now your certificate is ready to print out and will be posted there for future reference. If you have any questions, you can contact us and we hope to hear from you. So keep in touch at diabetesed.net and also on our Facebook page. This is Beverly Tomasian signing off.